Hello and welcome to the Home Assistant Podcast. My name is Phil Hawthorne. Joining me as usual, I've got my partner in crime, Mr. Rohan Karamandi. How's it going?
Good, how are you?
And today we are joined by Dan from the USA. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Phil. Thanks. Good to be here.
This episode is sponsored by Home Assistant Cloud by Nabucasa. Easily access your local Home Assistant instance remotely for a small monthly fee that supports the Home Assistant and ESP home projects. Configuration is done by the user interface, so there's no fiddling with router settings, SSL certs, or any other YAML.
So, Dan, whereabouts in the States are you?
It's Connecticut. We're recently supposed to get hit by a hurricane, and thought I might not have power yet, but we got pretty much nothing, so.
Oh, wow.
I guess that's better than, having no power.
Yeah.
All right. So, I guess obviously, you reach out to us at feedback@haspodcast.io and said, hey, I love the show and want to come on and talk about a little bit of the stuff I've done. So I guess let's start off with, how you sort of got started with Home Assistant.
I've always been sort of interested in computers and electronics. And in 2012, I think, I started as a backer for SmartThings on Kickstarter. And even before that, I'd been interested in home automation, but was never quite sure what to buy. There didn't seem to be, quite as any bundled packages.
Yeah, it was very high-end stuff as well. Like, if you wanted to get into anything home automation before, I think your only options were really stuff like X10. Or you had to go into like the tens of thousands of dollars in a proper, the rich people mansions would have, right?
Control 4 or something. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
About a year and a half ago, I switched over to Home Assistant mainly because I had heard that SmartThings would eventually be retiring the generation one hub that I had. When I switched over, I loved Home Assistant. I told friends I didn't quite recommend it to people who weren't computer savvy or there's always technical issues. They've gotten a lot better in the past year and a half that I've been using it. So, I may even recommend it to the less technically savvy. I'm thinking of setting up my dad with it.
Nice.
Yeah. I like their UI, isn't as dumbed down as the other, consumer-focused products. And I'm hoping that things will stay that way. I know, the consumer-focused products, they tend to, as time goes on, dumb down the UI and hide all the advanced features. One platform that I use that I wanted to talk about, I've never heard it mentioned here, is called My Sensors. It's kind of similar to ESP Home in that you create your own devices. And ESP Home, I've used it a little, easy to use, but this My Sensors, it requires a bit more, really have to be a programmer to use it. It will run on the Arduino. Are you familiar with those?
Yeah.
It's a little programmable
and
board. It will run on those, and you can program a lot more logic into the board itself than you can with ESP Home, I think. I also liked, I haven't actually done this, but you know, if you want to create something that runs on battery power, the my sensors, they use RF chips for communication that are much more low powered than Wi-Fi.
Interesting. Because that was going to be my next question. Because I've seen, like, my sensors is pretty popular. I've seen, you know, a lot of people recommending them on the community forums. But I've always thought, you know, maybe they're like, maybe, do you remember, Rohan, like Happy Bubbles, those like little Bluetooth beacons? I just assumed my sensors and Happy Bubbles were the same thing. I'm guessing, you know, completely different by the sound of it. But like if, you know, ESP Home obviously, you know, has Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, ESP32 chips have Bluetooth and Wi-Fi in them. So, you know, you need to power them via, you know, some form of power pack similar to a Raspberry Pi. But yeah, if it's got an RF chip that can be connected and doesn't need to constantly, you know, page over Wi-Fi, there could be like, yeah, I guess you could run it just from a battery pack.
Mm-hmm.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, so you can use, I already had a whole bunch of these little called NRF something chips, so that you can connect to the Arduino and use them to communicate with each other. And
right
before I used the My Sensors, it was always really, really difficult to get the things to communicate over the RF. You know, I basically had to get to all that low level stuff myself, and the My Sensors makes it super easy. The library handles all the communications, and don't really have to write any code for to handle the radio.
So in terms of, if you've got like an RF device, so let's say you've got for example a motion sensor that you want to connect through My Sensors over RF, do you have the code, you know, you create little My Sensors device on Arduino and have it push over RF. How do you then receive the motion sensor events into Home Assistant? Do you have like a My Sensors gateway that connects to RF, or do you need to get an RF radio yourself and sniff out the packets that are being sent across?
Yeah, so you start with a My Sensors gateway. You can connect it either via USB or Wi-Fi or MQTT.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so originally I created a My Sensors gateway on an Arduino that I connected via USB to my Raspberry Pi. So that was connected via USB and also had the RF chip to communicate with the all the other nodes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
When I upgraded my Raspberry Pi to use a SSD, I actually started having trouble. Like somehow the USB Arduino was interfering with the boot from the SSD. So at that point, I switched over to, I used a ESP8266 and created a My Sensors gateway that connects by Wi-Fi.
Nice, yep.
So one of my first Arduino projects way back when I was still using SmartThings.
Yeah.
I had some LG outlets with little RF controller light switches.
Right.
Like just using a, you know, proprietary RF. Those I had bought before I got any of the home automation stuff. Mm. And so once I started with SmartThings, I then basically took apart one of the remotes for those light switches and soldered some wires to it and hooked it up to our Arduino and was able to control it. And SmartThings had in the beginning they sold a thing called a thing shield.
Yes, yeah.
That you could basically bridge an Arduino to their hub.
Yeah.
And they discontinued it after quite a short time. I thought that was kind of disappointing, but I still had mine. It worked. So yeah, when I came to Home Assistant, I found this, found my sensors and switched it over to use that. And
so how did you know where to solder on that remote? Like, was it an RF remote that you were just able to get schematics for online and work out? Was there a tutorial that you had to follow? Or
no, a bit of trial and error.
That's awesome.
I like it. That is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, just, you know, I touched the wire here and saw the light turned on. So,
yeah.
I still don't know if, you know, I'm doing things kind of wrong that might eventually fry it, but
yep.
I'm surprised after 10 years it's still working. So
that's funny. I think, at least if it's still working after 10 years, then you've definitely got your money's worth out of it, right?
That's right.
Alec, on the show, you were talking recently about the stand-up desks. I have one that's, you know, I have a regular desk with a platform on it that just raises up and down. And when I got it, one of the first things I did to it was I created little device using a servo motor and some 3D printed parts to just press the buttons to make it go up and down.
Yeah.
And again, hook that into my sensors. And yeah, I thought it was funny. You thought I was the only one. Why would I want a desk that I can, you know, control with my voice assistant or anything? But then I heard on the show you guys started talking, and I was like, I guess other people do this too.
That's right. Yeah. Well, if it can be done, why not, right, at that point?
I think I was reading somewhere either on Twitter recently or on Reddit. I can't remember. I do apologize to whoever originally put it out there, but I think they have like a special like way of working. Like they want to do work spans in like 25 minutes. Like there's a name for this like type of working, right? Where you just go hard for 25 minutes and then maybe take a break for 10 minutes or something. But this would be a great use case for like a desk, right? Like if you need to focus for 25, like you could, for people that, you know, spend every day at their desk, you know, you could have your desk automated in that, you know, before lunch, you have to be standing up. Then after lunch, you know, it goes down automatically. Or, you know, if you've been sitting down for however long, it says, all right, now you've got to stand up and actually raise the desk up for you. So, yeah, I think, you know, a sit-stand desk is awesome idea to automate with.
Yeah, I think it'd be cool if you integrate it with, like, your, you know, whatever video, WebEx, Zoom, whatever, right? Like using whatever API. And it's like, okay, if you're on a call, you don't want the, you know, camera to look down, look like you're like playing like, oh, look at me go down the escalator or whatever, right? So, you know, it'd be actually pretty cool. That's something pretty interesting at that point. So
I actually liked the use case someone mentioned recently, that when their robot vacuum comes in the room, they'd have the desk raise up to get the
cords out the way. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that's a great use case. So I guess, so you mentioned before that you're considering moving, like getting Home Assistant in your dad's house. Have you got any ideas in what you want to achieve by doing that?
So he recently started getting some, basically he got all the Ring security system equipment. Nice. And I started looking into if I could integrate that with Home Assistant, and he was telling me that, you know, he was kind of didn't really want me to do that because he said the Ring security system is professionally monitored. I want to make sure we don't interfere with it. But he also, he has basically some IR controlled air conditioning and heating units.
Oh, yeah.
That he had mentioned he would like to be able to control remotely. And first I had bought him a Broadlink something device. Is able to control. I didn't really like their interface. Using their software, I was somehow only able to get the temperature to show in Celsius, which, you know, we don't use that much in the U.S.
True.
And so I was playing with Home Assistant and figured out how to do all the same things.
So did you just build out your own controller, or like how did you get to there, or like how did you get all that information out of it?
First I found how to integrate the Broadlink with Home Assistant, and there was a some third-party GitHub integration that could create a little climate controller for it. But then I created a little, using ESP Home, I created some sensors for it, like a temperature sensor, humidity sensor, and realized basically I'm giving him all this equipment and seeing what I can tie together. So I added a IR LED to the ESP Home, and found another ESP Home actually had something that will can do what I need with that.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you use ESP Home and you use My Sensors, you use like a bunch of the different things, right, based on kind of what works best for that scenario. How do you kind of gauge that, or is it just what code's available and what can I slap on here, or what? Like,
well, sometimes it's you know, what's easiest, what I've found to work with, but sometimes, like, at least for my own projects, I'll prefer the My Sensors. I want to have a lot of the Arduinos already, and I, you know, like to you know, I'm a software developer. I like programming the stuff, but you know, like for my dad, I figured the ESP Home, just a simple Wi-Fi thing, would be good.
So do you have like any off-the-shelf home automation products, or do you try to, or would you prefer, like, for example, like there is a product called Sensibo that you can use, and I think there's another one, Tato or Tato, however you want to pronounce it, that is just a Wi-Fi device designed to control like air conditioning units, for example. Would you do you have any devices that you've gone off the shelf with, or would you rather build it out in Arduino yourself, where you know you've got control to automate it with?
I do have a whole bunch of, you know, regular light switches and, door lock and, Z-Wave thermostat and,
nice.
I think one of the very first products I got when I got SmartThings was my smart door lock.
What brand did you get? Like the Yale or? I think there's a few now.
Schlage.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
That's been good to me. Except when the other day when the batteries died and I was outside without the key.
Yeah.
That is always my great. Fear, right?
Yeah, it's always great until you lock yourself out.
Yeah, prior to getting that thing, I used to lock myself out of my apartment all the time.
Yeah.
Since I got that, I was so smug, I thought, I don't need to hide a key outside. I'll never lock myself out.
What can go wrong now? Yeah.
Hey, everyone. I just wanted to take a minute to talk about the Eufy Video Lock. It's a smart lock that's really easy to set up with just a Phillips screwdriver and no extra drilling. It's got a keyless entry, so you don't need to worry about fumbling with the keys when your hands are full. Also, you don't need to worry about handing out extra keys when you're in a pinch, your kids losing them, or people copying the key and passing it around to each other. Something else I like about the Eufy Video Lock is that it has a camera built in and it works as a doorbell as well. Personally, I think the Eufy Video Lock is great for apartments or cottages where you can't necessarily add extra holes for a video doorbell. My favorite part about it, though, is that there isn't a monthly fee and your recordings are locally stored, so you don't have to worry about someone else owning your doorbell data. You can find it on Amazon, or if you want to know more, search Eufy Video Lock, that's EUFY Video Lock, or visit eufyofficial.com/video lock to see how you can gain complete control of your door.
Does the door lock you have, because I know there's a few versions, Z-Wave, some of it just, keypads only, but others also have like a key on the door as well. Do you have the key version as well? So if you weren't so smug and had a key in your wallet, would you have been able to open the door?
Yes. So okay. I've learned I need to copy the key and put one outside somewhere.
Yeah.
I heard the newer ones also have contacts on the bottom where you can hold a 9-volt battery to them if it's dead.
That's kind of cool.
Unfortunately, mine does not.
Yeah. I've always thought, though, like, what is the point of having those contacts? Like, if you get home and it's, 3 o'clock in the morning, you get home and the door lock doesn't work anymore, you've got more chance of carrying a key with you than you do a 9-volt battery to get enough power to unlock your door. And you're not going down to the supermarket or anywhere to get a 9-volt battery at 3 a.m. You're probably just going to... Just going to knock the door down, right? I don't know. Unless you're then hiding a 9-volt battery in your garden for some reason. I just think then you're better off just hiding a key, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. But, there's a lot of people, and I myself do this too, you find a trusted neighbor and you're like, okay, here's a key, right?
Or here's my 9-volt battery. If I ever come at 3 a.m. in the morning for a 9-volt battery, you need to give it to me. Yeah, don't give me a cup of sugar, but give me a 9-volt battery.
I'm sure they'd love you when you're knocking on the door for a 9-volt battery. But
I guess you could keep a battery in your car, and then if someone steals your car or breaks into your car, they don't get a key to your house, which that would probably be the ideal place.
Yeah.
One thing I kind of wanted to ask you guys about was, for my light switches, always thought it was kind of important to still have a physical light switch. So you can, I have a few Z-Wave light switches that I've wired in, but yep. you know, that's a real pain to do yourself, or yeah. if you get an electrician, that's expensive. I wanted to talk about the Shelly products. That's, I guess you still need to wire those in, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So from my understanding, yeah, you need, definitely need to, you need to wire them in, similar to what you would do with like a Z-Wave a Z-Wave dimmer or a switch, right? You'd still have like your momentary switch at the front, but then behind it you have the actual smarts behind it.
So basically you still have your same existing switch, right?
And yep.
Yeah.
Because I think, Ryan, we had a guest on recently that had Shelly, and they were saying that because they just have the same, the toggle switches, right? But mm-hmm. behind them are Shelly. So everything, it looks like a normal switch. But as soon as you've turned it off or on, Shelly in the background will know that, you know, okay, it's been toggled. Do a state or send a notification that's been changed.
Exactly. So the paddle or the flick or whatever, the outside of the switch essentially is just used as a, exactly what you said, Phil, as a toggle. And essentially Shelly is like, okay, it's keeping state of that, and it's also keeping, obviously it's got the relay to keep it to, you know, cut on and off the power as well.
Yep.
And at that point it kind of does what it has to do, whether it's on or off or blink or whatever.
So Shelly can toggle the actual light on and off, and the switch is just notifying Shelly.
Yeah, exactly.
Basically,
So that way, let's say you've got like a switch, right? And, you know, generally, I'm thinking of how American switches are, like up is off and down is on. So in that case, you know, if
other way up is on, other way is off.
Okay. Yeah. So
I find that, sometimes, you know, I don't really pay much attention to that. Like sometimes they seem to be one way, sometimes the other, I don't know.
Yeah. I've literally been in before I bought this house, I was, again, quite a few years ago. And when I was looking at houses and stuff, there was one house which was, you know, two switch, I think it was the bathroom, two switches, one for the fan and one for the lights, and the lights was up is on and fan was down is on or something like that. And I was like, oh my god, okay. Oh, so this is clearly somebody that just, a proper electrician would not do that.
Yeah.
Right. Yep. Like, and but yeah, it was just, oh my god, like it was annoying.
But yeah, so I guess, you know, if in that situation, like if you've got a switch and you go into Home Assistant and you tell Home Assistant to change the state of whatever light is connected to that Shelly, the switch, of course, obviously on the wall won't move. But then when you go up to the wall and you toggle the switch to the opposite direction, Shelly will then know, okay, the switch has been moved and the light is on, so now turn it off. I guess, you know, it makes it a bit better for people that, you know, don't want to care, like don't care about, you know, Home Assistant or, you know, any smart home. They just, if they flick a switch, they expect something to happen. So I guess that's where it comes in handy.
Yeah. But again, the general guidance is still like, if, you know, if you want to switch out this entire like switch itself, right, and do that, if you're not comfortable with doing that, or you'd want to call an electrician to do that, I mean, realistically, you probably should call one for the, to do the Shelly too, right? Because you're still working with the power.
Yeah.
Right? So that's the only...
And just, if you're outside, I don't know, like you crazy North Americans, right? I guess you only got 120 volts or something, but if you're in Australia, you do need an electrician. You must, you know, it is law that you have to get an electrician to do it. I don't know what, you know, you crazy people in North America think you're doing, but yeah, definitely get a professional in all the time. Especially
what's the slang that you guys call them? Sparkers?
Sparkies.
No. Sparkies.
Sparky, get a Sparky in to do your switches, right?
Yeah, and I think generally it is pretty similar here. I think it's also like you take somewhat of a risk, right? If something happens, whatever, your house burns down, and the insurance is like, can I see the electrician that did this? And you're like, well, I kind of did it myself. They're gonna tell you to go pound sand when you ask for you know, how much ever your house costs, right? So there's some level of risk there too, I think. And it depends on jurisdiction too, right? I guess it depends on, you know, region or county or whatever based where you're based.
What was making you think of the Shelly's, Dan? Like, wouldn't, I know you mentioned you've got a Z-Wave door lock. Like, wouldn't you try and stick with the Z-Wave ecosystem?
Well, yeah, I do. That's also one of the reasons I prefer the My Sensors over ESP Home. I do kind of like to stay away from the Wi-Fi things I can, but I don't know. I do use some Wi-Fi equipment. I think the Wi-Fi might be more reliable than, Z-Wave I don't think I've had a problem with, but Zigbee, I have some Zigbee stuff too, and that occasionally drops.
It's interesting. But what are you using to power your Zigbee network? Is it still going through the SmartThings hub, like as the controller?
At first, I did it. First, when I switched over to the Home Assistant, I was still using the SmartThings to control it, but I eventually bought a Nortec.
Oh yeah,
nice. USB, yeah.
Z-Wave and Zigbee dongle.
Because I found, like, since moving over to Decons with my Zigbee network, it has been so much more reliable, because I was always, like, giving so much shade to Zigbee. You can go back in early episodes of the podcast, right? Like, I was frustrated to the hell with my Zigbee network. I thought I was running those CC2531 chips with Zigbee to MQTT.
That's the one you have to sniff and whatever, right?
Yeah, that's the worst. Like, for whatever reason, like, Philips Hue and Xiaomi devices just wouldn't act as repeaters for each other. And I have, like, you know, 20-odd Litify Osram Zigbee lights that wouldn't act as repeaters. But since moving over to Decons, like, yeah, everything has just been a super Zigbee network. Granted, I do have a couple of Zigbee lights that randomly go unavailable or need to be repaired. Like, I've got an IKEA light bulb out in the garage that is no longer connected. But, you know, other That's than that, bizarre. Like, yeah, it's very strange. But other than that, yeah, Zigbee's been pretty rock solid, which I've been quite impressed with.
Yeah.
I think I finally got most of my stuff stable and not dropping. Added a few, just a few outlets that I don't even need, but just act as repeaters.
Yeah.
Yep. Are you using any, like, voice assistants, or have you got any tablets around the home to do any, like, interfacing with Home Assistant?
Yeah, I do use the Amazon one all the time.
Mm-hmm. How do you primarily interact with Home Assistant then? So is it, do you use a tablet, or is the tablet just like a, because I know we were talking about this in the last episode we recorded, where, like, again, Phil has his tablet for, like, a MQTT alarm panel, right? Like, what do you use a tablet for, and is that primarily how you drive your Home Assistant installation, or do you use voice primarily, or, like?
Yeah, so I do use mainly my Amazon device.
Yep.
Voice assistant.
Yeah. Appreciate you not saying the name.
I rarely go into the UI itself. Usually it's only if I'm away from home or something that I'll go into the UI to. I also have the. I guess it's just a HomeKit integration right in the Home Assistant. And so I use that to interact with it through Siri on my phone.
Nice.
Obviously, I have an iPhone.
Yeah.
Sometimes when I'm away from home, that seems to have trouble communicating, so I'll go into the UI and control things that way.
Interesting. Yeah.
But another thing I was looking at was I was looking at MQTT. I've been kind of interested in, you know, seeing what I can do with that, but I am wondering, like, why do I, what will MQTT do for me that I can't do?
MQTT is great for bridging systems together that don't natively talk to each other. So, you know, Home Assistant has MQTT Discovery, which is a standard that Home Assistant has for itself, where other third-party systems can then create entities in Home Assistant on the fly. But it's also good for, you know, just as an example, I have a Rainforest Eagle, which gets the current power usage from my meter for electricity. And it then connects, so that gets the electricity that I'm currently using for the whole house, and then publishes that to an MQTT topic, just as a current, like a sensor value. And then I have a sensor in Home Assistant that knows to read that MQTT topic to get the value out. And so now I can get, you know, my whole house energy usage in Home Assistant as a sensor, which then goes into the energy dashboard. And I can then push that over into InfluxDB from Home Assistant.
Yeah. I like to think of it as, you know, that one place where everybody says, hey, here's my state. Or you say, hey, go become the state, right? One of those two. Yep. And based on that, it will, it's one single place that, you know, all of these, let's say thousands of devices can talk to. And you can pull everything from that one place, right? And the nice thing with MQTT is because it's separate from Home Assistant and things like that. Again, even though it might be, you know, you might be using like Home Assistant OS or whatever. Regardless, it's still technically separate from Home Assistant. It holds state there too, right? So, you know, when Home Assistant boots up, it goes, okay, great. Well, what is this switch? And it just looks at MQTT and it says, okay, it's on, right? Whatever. Or, you know, what was the last known temperature of whatever else? Oh, 26. Great. Right. So that's the other nice thing too. But I got to say, Dan, I do appreciate you asking that question because I think we've talked about MQTT maybe 7,000 times on this show, but we've never actually explained it. So that is, I actually really do appreciate you asking that.
The first few times I had heard about it, which may have been here, I was always like, what is this? And
you know, it's funny how many of those things, like, it's, again, even Phil just mentioned Rainforest Eagle. As he said that, I'm like, Rainforest Eagle, why does that sound familiar? And like Googling it and like looking at what it is and whatever, right? But this is genuinely why, I think why Phil and I do the show too, because it's like, we don't know half these things. So it's like, it's a good way for people to tell us what things people are looking at and so on. So
the good thing about MQTT as well is that there's so many like random devices that, because it's, you know, a standard that random devices will just connect to, right? So I think I have a Dyson smart fan and heater combo, and there is a custom component in Home Assistant which I believe you can use local connection to the Dyson, because it basically connects to the Dyson. They run their own MQTT or something. I could be mistaken, but I'm pretty sure that's how I've read it. So there's a lot of like random things that could just connect to an MQTT broker that you define, and then you can then suck out that information. You know, there's heaps of software out there to view what's going on an MQTT server. You can just, you know, create a sense of value from it in Home Assistant and away you go. The good thing about MQTT as well is that it's very, very lightweight, and so it's very, it's made for Internet of Things devices, right? Very smart, very snappy, right? So because it's basically text, the payloads that are going across are very small. And because of that, you know, it's great for, you know, if you send an on command over MQTT, the receiving device is going to get it very quickly. So it becomes, you know, fantastic for, you know, all those smart home devices that need instant status updates.
It scales crazy, like a lot too. So
I'm guessing, basically if there's not a native integration in Home Assistant for your product, then chances are you can use MQTT for it.
Maybe, yeah. If they expose, if they expose MQTT or allow you to, or the glad their device to connect to your MQTT server or broker, I should say, in this, to use the correct terminology. But there are ways. So for example, I've created, HA Docomon, which I am currently work like in my, dev branch, which I apologize, I haven't updated for quite some time. I have the ability for, Docker containers to be exposed to Home Assistant as switch entities, and that's all powered by MQTT. So you could have servers running around the home with Docker containers running on them, and you know the little script that I've written will then publish a state to MQTT, which will then get fed into Home Assistant to say, you know, this Docker container is up or down, or you know, running this image. You know, if you have the ability to access an API. For example, if you can find an API for an air conditioner that might not be integrated with Home Assistant, but you don't want to do a complete integration for Home Assistant, maybe you're like me, you don't know Python, you don't want to go down the whole writing a custom component, you could create your own little script in whatever language you prefer. Mine would be Node.js. You know, write a little script, interface with the air conditioner's API, and publish that into topics into MQTT, and then you can bring that into Home Assistant with the MQTT climate device, for example. So yeah, many of you, like if you're like, I know you're a software developer yourself, so I think that would be probably the best use case, like for you to be, if you can access APIs, bridge them and pull them in as Home Assistant entities through MQTT.
Yeah. So a lot of times you'd need that, like, you know, third party script or something that you build yourself that, you know, that lets you take whatever and then dump that in a standardized way into MQTT, right?
Mm.
Some of the other more interesting things is, like, I've got security cameras that do, again, object detection and things like that. So it does like a people count and things like that. And they actually natively dump into MQTT. So to say, like, okay, great. So now I can actually take that and overlay that information where, you know, from a Home Assistant perspective, that might mean that, okay, this is just a numeric counter, right? To say, okay, I have three people that it sees, right? Or whatever.
So then you have like a sensor that says people count in living room 3.
Correct. Exactly. Yep. Based on what the camera sees and so on, right? And then same, it does the same with like Lux and all that stuff. So, but all of this stuff is coming from a camera, right? So how do I natively pull a lot of that stuff in? So because they deliver that mechanism via MQTT, I can just say, okay, you know, Home Assistant, look at this value and that is how bright the room is. Look at this other value and that's how many people are in this room. Right. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And before I really knew too much about MQTT, one of my main questions was always, like, I didn't understand, was it over Wi-Fi, which I guess now I know that's pretty much what it would run over Wi-Fi, right?
So MQTT definitely requires like some form of connection over, you know, LAN, basically. You know, you can have an MQTT broker running up in the cloud if you want to, and you can, you know, bridge devices. You know, you could have car GPS trackers, I think, might publish to an MQTT broker up in the cloud, and then you can have Home Assistant connect to that and pull in your car's location, for example. Or you can just have it running locally. But yeah, the upshot of it is, because it's IP-based, you would need the device or some bridge to the device to be connected to the internet or to your local network to be able to connect to that broker.
Yeah, thanks.
And so, Dan, like, so I guess, you know, we mentioned before that, you know, you're going to move Home Assistant up into your dad's house and go that way. What about your own home? Like, how many people have you got running? How many people have you got at home at the moment? And do you have to account for anyone else in your home with using Home Assistant?
Well, it's just me in my home, so
yeah.
Which, you know, can be kind of convenient when, you know, when things go down, when they aren't working, there's no one to complain, so.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely take those blessings if you want. When one thing doesn't work, you say, hey, turn on this light, and it's like, you just get yelled at, but.
Yeah, and you know, and when something doesn't work, you know, rather than go over and flip the switch manually, I have to come in here and, you know, spend an hour trying to figure out why it's not working.
That's right. That's right.
That is
why bother trying to fix it, or why bother trying to just go up to it and flick a switch when you can spend several hours trying to troubleshoot something, right? But
and so what are you using for presence detection, or do you even bother with presence detection, or just use the Home Assistant app as, you know,
the Home Assistant app on my iPhone. I have you know, I'm sure everyone probably has had some few false you know, yeah. I'll be sitting at home and suddenly all the lights will turn off because Home Assistant thinks I'm not home. So I set up like a virtual person entity in Home Assistant. Forgot exactly how I did that, but I also have a sensor pinging my iPhone.
Right.
That's not always not too reliable because, you know, a lot of times the iPhone goes to sleep. And,
yeah.
But that combined with GPS, I forgot exactly how I made it more reliable, but somehow it is.
Sounds like you could use like a Bayesian sensor as well, like probability, you know, if you're within 5 kilometers of home and, you know, your phone was last connected to the network, you know, within 30 minutes and you're probably home, right? But then if you go outside of that radius and your phone hasn't been connected for a while, you're not home.
Yeah.
I guess that's one way to improve it.
Phil loves his Bayesian sensor, by the way. He talks about this all the time.
I really like I find them very confusing to set up. But I do like the, you know, probability of things. I'd have to check my config to see what Bayesian sensor I've got set up at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
I have one. Oh yeah, and so I have a Bayesian sensor set up for the home to consider if someone is in her side. Like, so I don't care if someone's home, but you know, if any of the motion sensors have detected motion, or if their TV is on. You know, if the guest mode is activated, these all add into probabilities to say that, you know, if something, depending on how many things are open, like true, then, you know, the home will know that someone is inside.
Right.
And then, of course, if, you know, two motion sensors get activated and the alarm panel is activated or armed, I should say, then I'll get an alert. But if, you know, one of the motion sensors is just bugging out because a car's driven past and a shadow's come across the wall, I don't want to necessarily get an alert to say that someone's broken in if one motion sensor's detected something.
Hmm. I might look into that. What is that?
So the Bayesian sensor, it's like a platform that's native to Home Assistant. And it basically takes a group of sensors. So you define the sensors. So for example, if I was to give it two motion sensors or three motion sensors, I could say that if, you know, the two motion sensors at the front of the house, if, you know, if they're both marked as seeing motion, I might give them a weight of, you know, like 60% or 0.6, probability that, you know, someone is in the house. And then for the whole sensor, you have like a threshold. And if the threshold goes above, you know, like 85% or something, then the Bayesian sensor goes from true, so, sorry, from false to true, and then you know that someone is there. Like, there's a whole, I can't explain it verbally, but there is a whole lot of documentation that can do it better. It is the Bayesian sensor. We'll leave links in the show notes, obviously. But yeah, it's been in Home Assistant for quite some time. And I think it's a really powerful sensor. Like, obviously, I've just done an example of using motion sensors, but I know people have, I think even in the Home Assistant docs, there's been some great examples of just random things that people can ascertain, you know, if something is working or not.
Yeah.
I think someone's done like washing machine detecting if it's running or not based on power levels, and, you know, door states and a whole bunch of stuff. So
yeah, definitely look into that. I was gonna ask you how to spell that, but if it's in your show notes, I'll pull it.
There. Just in case people are listening, it's Bayesian.
All right. Well, Dan, thanks so much for taking the time today to talk to us. Really appreciate it. Like, I'm definitely gonna have to look into these My Sensor things, and maybe I'm gonna have to buy a soldering iron, I think.
Ooh.
Randomly soldering things, right? And hope for, like, I strike gold like Dan did. No,
like that. I'm terrible at soldering, but, you know, whenever I have to solder, I'm, you know, deathly afraid I'm going to short something, but...
blow something up, yeah.
That's why I've refused to buy one so far.
And usually I do end up shorting something and then spend hours extra trying to unsolder
it. Yeah.
This is why I buy pre-made things, right?
That's right.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much, Dan. We really do appreciate it. Speak soon. Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers.
If you want to share your Home Assistant journey or come on as a guest, reach out to us at feedback@hasspodcast.io. That's hasspodcast.io.
The Home Assistant Podcast is hosted by Phil Hawthorne and myself, Rohan Karamandi. For links to topics we discussed today, check out our show notes on hasspodcast.io.